Well, I'm sure you picked up from the scripture reading that we are going to be looking at the birth of Moses this morning for Mother's Day. But I want to begin with the New Testament commentary on what Steve just read to you. So open your Bibles, for starters, to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. All through the scripture, as you know, we see this emphasis on faith. The just shall live by faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Walk by faith, not by sight. You're saved by faith. Faith is what honors God. Faith is what God honors. And Hebrews 11 is the proof of that. This is the hall of faith, a record of the triumphs of faith. This is the cloud of witnesses surrounding us. Hebrews 12:1 refers to men and women of the Old Testament who are famous for their faith. These are the MVPs. These are the VIPs of the Old Testament, forever enshrined as examples for us. Of what? Of the fact that living by faith works. It is the way to live. It does honor God. God is trustworthy. Trust Him. Persevere in the faith. Keep trusting God. That's what these did. They trusted God. They believed His word, even in the midst of extreme circumstances. They operated not by what their eyes could see and understand, but by faith. They lived by faith. They chose to act in obedience to God, regardless of how hard or risky or dangerous or costly or foolish or countercultural or counterintuitive or un-PC it may have seemed to them or to others. And so the whole chapter really is a catalog of examples of that. By faith, Abel offered a sacrifice. By faith, Enoch walked with God and was taken. By faith, Noah built an ark. By faith, Abraham left home. By faith, Sarah conceived in her old age. By faith, Abraham offered up Isaac. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob. By faith, Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph. By faith, Joseph gave orders concerning his bones. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. By faith, Rahab hid spies, and so on. And then countless others, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, on and on it goes. Verse 38, men and women of whom the world was not worthy. And then in the middle of that, at a really crucial time in redemptive history, the mother of Moses. Verse 23 says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now, whose faith are we talking about there? Not Moses. Moses in verse 24 and following. But in verse 23, it's the faith of his parents, right? His dad and his mom, especially his mom, as we're going to see. But to think about that, how would you like to be in this hall of faith, mentioned, but not by name? To be remembered as his parents. Would that be okay? Just to do whatever the unique circumstances of your life situation call for, not to be famous, but just to be faithful? That's motherhood, isn't it? That's motherhood. By faith, moms have babies. By faith, moms hide babies. By faith, moms nurse their babies and love them and care for them and teach them and train them and pray for them. By faith, moms watch their babies grow up and leave home and go off to do that for which God brought them into the world. By faith, moms let go of their babies and trust God with them. And so, of all people, moms must live by what? Faith. Moms, are you doing that? What are you trusting in? What sustains you day by day to keep doing all the things you do for your children? We know it's faith, hope, and love, but faith in what? Faith in what? especially in our day, bringing a child into this world would seem cruel, careless. Why would you even do it apart from faith? And so, faith in what is the question? We'll go back to Exodus chapter 1 and let's find out. By faith, Moses was hidden for 3 months by his parents. By faith in what? I'd like to suggest to you from the mother of Moses 5 objects of your faith. By faith in what do mothers do what they do? Number one, by faith in God's plan. Just to set the context, look at the first half of Exodus chapter 1 and remember that the sons of Israel are in Egypt and have been now for almost 400 years. You remember the Joseph story and how in spite of the evil intentions of his brothers, God positioned Joseph in Egypt to become a ruler and their deliverer from the great famine that struck that part of the world during his lifetime. And so all the descendants of Jacob transplanted to Egypt and settled in the land of Goshen. And now they have increased greatly and multiplied. And the land is filled with them, verse 7 says. And the new king, the new Pharaoh, doesn't know Joseph. Doesn't sense any kind of loyalty or obligation to him or to his family. In fact, at this point, he's afraid of them. Verse 9, he said to his people, "Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply. And in the event of war, they will join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and all kinds of labor in the fields, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Now, if you don't know the context, when you read that, you would think it's a pretty hopeless situation, right? Why bring a child into that world? Pretty hopeless. But there is a context. 400 years in Egypt was always part of the plan. It's not the whole plan. It's not the end and goal of the plan, but it's part of the plan. 400 years in Egypt is how the sons of Israel became a nation. It's how they became a people, a multitude of people. They came 70 in number, verse 5 says. And now they are too many and too mighty for us. Well, that was the plan. That was the promise to Abraham, wasn't it? Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 17. To make of you a great nation, a father of a multitude, more numerous than the stars in the sky, the sands of the sea. Well, that happened, and it happened not in the promised land. It happened in Egypt. It happened under affliction. In fact, the more they were afflicted, what does it say in verse 12? The more they multiplied. That promise to Abraham is, in fact, how the book of Genesis ends. Look at verse 24 there, that last chapter in Genesis. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." That's the plan, see. So what's in play here then in Exodus chapter 1 and following, and the parents of Moses would know this, is nothing less than the Abrahamic covenant. God chose this people to be His people. God committed Himself to be their God. God worked in His marvelous providence to protect them and preserve them through the famine. He has kept them safe. He has multiplied them. Affliction has unified them. They're not slaves in Egypt because God has forgotten them. They're slaves in Egypt for a reason, for a season. Because God has chosen them to be a people for His own possession who will proclaim the excellencies of Him to the nations. There's a plan. And so every mom then and every mom now must embrace and trust the plan, the sovereign will and plan and purpose and promise of God, that regardless of how things look politically and economically and socially and morally, it's God's blueprint and God's schedule and God's timing and God's plan and program that is unfolding, that men and nations and families are operating by. He has a plan. Where we are right now at this moment in history fits into that plan. My life, your family, your nation, all of it fits into the plan. And even if I don't know what the plan is, it doesn't matter. God does. And He's operating according to that plan. And so you can live by faith that His plans don't fail, right? His plans always succeed. So moms, live by faith in God's plan. And remember, too, the parents of Moses here had limited revelation of that plan, right? Limited revelation. They didn't have the scriptures, the law, the Torah. Their son would write them. They didn't have any special revelation from God concerning their son. No angelic messenger came and announced his birth or his special mission as God's deliverer and lawgiver and prophet and leader. They had limited but sufficient revelation. And so do we. And so that's enough for us to live by faith in God's plan and God's promises. Secondly, faith in God's protection. Increasing their labor didn't decrease their number. And so the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, issued a second edict in verse 15. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was Shiphrah and the other Puah, and said, when you're helping the Hebrew women give birth and you see them upon the birth stool, if it's a son, put him to death. If it's a daughter, let her live. Gender selective infanticide, okay? Gender selective partial birth or post-birth abortion. That's nothing new. The girls will make fine slaves. The boys may grow up to be warriors. Kill them. Exterminate them. And the Hebrew midwives, these were Hebrew women serving in this role. The two that are named would have been in charge of all the others and expected to relay this instruction and make sure it gets carried out. Kill all the male babies. The birth stool is an interesting thing, and there's all kinds of speculation about what it was. Apparently some contraption that made birthing easier, whether it was simply two flat stones, one for each foot, and the mother would squat and give birth that way, or some conjecture that it was some kind of potter's wheel-like spinning disc that she stood over that actually helped to twist the baby out of the womb, or possibly some kind of toilet stool where running water drained away and the midwife could say, oops,
That one slipped. Sorry.
But either way, it's some kind of either partial birth or afterbirth abortion that's obviously intended here. But it didn't work, did it? Verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. And so the king called for them and said, why have you done this? And let the boys live. And they said, the Hebrew women, they're not like the Egyptian women. They're vigorous women. The word is the Hebrew word for life, you know, energy, vitality, strong women. Apparently the Egyptian women were much more delicate and dainty than that. And it probably wasn't a lie to say that. They weren't having to make that up as a cover up. Apparently there were no repercussions from the king for their failure to carry out his decree, so he must have believed them. The Hebrew women were vigorous. They have the babies before we can even come. And maybe the moms weren't calling them. But at any rate, God honored them, verse 20 says. Verse 21, he established households and families for them. So then the king issued another decree, verse 22. Every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you're to keep alive. Now, I just want you to imagine being a mom in that environment. Okay? I mean, we think our world around us, we look around and we think how bad things are. Imagine expecting a child, carrying a child full term, knowing what? If it's a girl, she's a slave for life. If it's a boy, death. Instantly. That's a pretty bleak outlook. I mean, that would be tough, wouldn't it? To be a mom and to bring a child into the world in a country, in a culture where that's the political agenda of the day, kill the boys. Gender selective abortion. Fortunately today, things are much easier. Gender can be decided later. Or never. Or changed. What a mess, right? But that's the point. The world is a mess. It's a fallen and broken world. And the sobering reality then for any mother is that you can bring a child into this world, you cannot save them from it. And so you must trust in God's protection. But it's amazing to me, isn't it to you, how often you find in important and influential and strategic places of power, government institutions and agencies, people who fear God. I mean, many don't, obviously, but some do. It seems like there's always some who do. Maybe a lawyer or judge or a caregiver or school teacher or administrator or claims adjuster, but a person that God will use to do what's right in a world gone wrong. A person with a conscience, a person with compassion, a woman with children of her own, whatever the case may be, but however cruel and corrupt a governing authority may be, the execution of the policies and procedures always comes down to real people. And that's often where it stalls out, because real people simply can't find it in themselves to do to real people what rulers require. And sometimes we thank God for that, don't we? I think of Joseph and his ordeal and how God protected him, or Daniel and his colleagues, you know, taken off prisoner to a foreign land and how God protected them, or Esther and God's just providential work in her life, or David and how he protected David from Saul. On and on and on it goes. And so the point is, no matter how careful we are, no matter how much we try, we cannot always protect our children. We can't keep them perfectly safe. We have to trust in God's protection. And let's face it, every time you let them out of your sight, aren't you doing that? Aren't you praying that? Lord, protect them. Keep them safe. Watch over them. And you even go beyond that, right? Even if they do wrong, even if they put themselves in situations they shouldn't be in, would you, Father, put someone there? Put someone there with a conscience. Put someone there who fears God, who will do the right thing, who will have mercy. I don't think you could be a mom if you didn't have faith in God's protection. Thirdly, faith in God's provision. And this is the fun part, chapter 2, verse 1. A man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And we don't discover their names until chapter 6, Amram and Jochebed. But both Levites, the tribe that would serve as priests, verse 2, she conceived and bore a son. And this would be by now at least their third child, because Miriam and Aaron were older and had already escaped this latest edict of the king. But when she saw that he was beautiful. Interesting there, it's the Hebrew term for good. God saw that it was good. It's that word, meaning perfect, meaning couldn't be any better. So this was the perfect baby boy, meaning healthy, beautiful, perfect. And it's not suggesting that the child had more value because it was so beautiful, or they wouldn't have spared the child had it not been so beautiful. But the point is, in ancient times, that was taken as a sign of God's favor, God's blessing, or perhaps that God had something special in view in the history, in the future of this child. The Old Testament scholar Dalich says the beauty of the child was to her a peculiar token of divine approval and a sign that God had some special design concerning him. So that heightened then their sense of wanting to protect this child. So she hid him, it says, for 3 months. And as we read in Hebrews 11, that act became the tangible expression of their faith, right? She didn't fear the king. She hid the child. Human life was more important than honoring the king. Sometimes fear God and honor the king are compatible, and sometimes they aren't. By faith, she preserved life. She did what parental love requires, not what Pharaoh's law required. But she could only hide him for so long. I mean, eventually the kid grows up, his lungs get bigger, his cries get louder. So it gets harder to do that. So in verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch so he could float. And then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds of the bank of the Nile. She didn't drop it in the river and let it float off. She tucked it in there so it wouldn't float off and would be found. Verse 4, his sister then also stood at a distance, Miriam, to find out what would happen to him. Now, we can assume that all of this was strategically done. Okay. This wasn't just a long-term, clever way to keep the child hidden indefinitely. The Nile River was the heart and soul of life in Egypt. They worshipped the Nile. It was holy water, life-giving water. It had supernatural powers to heal, to impart fruitfulness, fertility. And so, of course, the daughter of Pharaoh would go there to bathe. They knew that. And they knew where. And so Jochebed had thought this through. It was all premeditated. Verse 5, the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid and said, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child. And behold, the lad was crying, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Their plan worked, in other words. They found the basket. They saw the baby. A little crying tugged at their heartstrings. And the reaction is what? Totally predictable. Aww! How cute! That's predictable. It's women. And then Miriam, conveniently standing by, not too close to give it all away, but close enough to, at an appropriate time, offer a reasonable suggestion,
shall I go and find a Hebrew mom to nurse the baby for you? What a delightful young girl. Yes, great idea. Thank you. Do that.
And who did she bring back? But
his mother.
And I don't know, verse 9, you know, she says to her, take the child away and nurse him for me and I'll give your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. I just picture a little more to it than that. Maybe a little bit of Jewish bargaining going on here, just for fun. Will you nurse this baby for me? Oh, I don't know. I got kids of my own, you know, and we're really busy with the bricks and such. And I'd have to talk it over with my husband. I'd pay you your wages. Oh, well, I mean, I would do it for free, but it's, I mean, okay. You know. So she took the child and nursed him. But what irony, right, that by Pharaoh's decree, Moses should have been killed. Now by Pharaoh's daughter, he'll live. And live securely and live well. All at Pharaoh's expense. In verse 10, then, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Probably nursing age, you know, she probably would have stretched it as long as she could. But typically, I think, 2 or 3, 4 tops. So she brought the child to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses because I drew him out of the water. Now look, I understand this is unique, but isn't your child? These are unique circumstances, right? Special providences. Divine provision was in play here in remarkable ways, and God's provision may not look like this in your case. It may take a much more generic form, much less dramatic, more mundane, which I'm sure you hope it does, right? But the principle is the same. You are trusting in God's provision. And you must. You must. How He provides and what He provides may vary from house to house and from child to child, but that He provides is the constant that we all depend on. And I think examples like these, sprinkled as they are throughout the Bible, at least give us the confidence that God can do stuff like this, can't He? Anytime He wants. It's not hard for God to make these kinds of providential arrangements and divine appointments and connections. It's easy for Him. It's His specialty. In fact, I think God rather prefers to work through natural providences than He does through supernatural miracles. Miracles are easy. Zap! Done! But to work through providence, and to make all these connections and arrangements fit together, I think God delights to work that way. So the point is, look, the Lord knows how beautiful your babies are. He knows what their needs are. He knows all about the unique dangers and risks and political agendas and egomaniacs of the world around you. He knows perfectly well how to provide for your child. He's a father. He knows how to do that. He knows how to take care of children. So just remember that. No matter how bleak things may look around us today in our world, morally, politically, economically, we can trust God's provision. Now, we could stop there, but we can't stop there. Because some of you have grown children. Right? Maybe even adult children. And so you need to hear these next two. Notice verse 11. It came about in those days when Moses had grown up. See, this is the problem with the whole arrangement, isn't it? They grow up. Or they don't. But they do, you know, and they grow up way too fast, right? Moses grew up, notice, in the white space between verse 10 and 11. That's how fast they grow up. If you blink, bam, you missed it. But just because they grow up doesn't mean you're not still their mom. Right? I'll always be your mom. And they'll always be your what? Baby. So you must live by faith, not only in God's plan and protection and provision, but also in God's preparation. And all we have on the gap between verse 10 and 11 is Stephen's sermon in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, where he says, Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds, but when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. So grown up equals 40, just to encourage you a little bit on that. Relax. But do the math, okay? So 3 years at home, that's nursery school, that's phase one. Then 37 years in Pharaoh's court, and probably four of those at least at the U of E. That's phase two. And you think, all right, his training after 40 years is complete, right? You think he's ready. He's ready to lead. No, he's not even ready to serve. So watch what happens. Verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, because he knew what he was about to do was wrong. And when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, why are you striking your companion? But he said, who made you a prince or judge over us? You going to kill me too? And then Moses knew the gig was up, man. He was in danger. The matter had become known. Now you think about that, Mom. Think about that. Because I guarantee you, whatever your plan is for your child, it doesn't include murder. Nowhere in your plan for your child was there a murder. I'm just guessing. You want them to have passion. You want them to have compassion. You want them to love justice and hate injustice. You want them to care about the poor and the oppressed. You want them to see needs and problems and take initiative to solve them. But nowhere in your plan for your child is there a dead Egyptian buried in the sand. Now what do you do? But the training, see, and the maturing and the preparing of Moses was not complete. Your part, maybe, not God's. Not God's. So don't confuse their education with their training. Verse 15, when Pharaoh heard the matter, he tried to kill Moses. So Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. And you know the rest. That led to what? 40 years in Midian, tending sheep for his father-in-law, Jethro, phase 3. Verse 23 says, now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel and took notice of them. Now Moses. So what's going on? Preparation. 40 years of preparation. 40 years to prepare Egypt. 40 years to prepare Israel. 40 years to prepare Moses. Moms, are you willing to trust God's preparation? Will you by faith believe that the mistakes and sins and impulsive acts and foolish choices of your children somehow fit into God's plan for their lives? Will you believe that both when you have everything under control and when everything's out of control, God is still in control? And that all of us are on a short leash when it comes to God's plan and God's purposes in this world? We can't mess it up. In fact, all our mess ups somehow fit into it. Nothing's wasted. Nothing's wasted. Do you have that much faith? Trust God with your grown up children. The perfect one. And the other ones. The favorite one. And all of them. Trust God. Let them go. Trust God to use every experience in their life. Every experience, good or bad. Trust God to use every relationship in their life. Every relationship, good or bad, to educate them, to equip them, to shape them, to change them, to mold them, to prepare them for whatever it is that He has for them in the future. You have to do that. And then whenever you begin to lose patience and wonder about all that, and you start saying, "How long, O Lord, how long?" Just remember Moses, 40 years in Egypt, 40 more in Midian. That's the hardest thing, isn't it, anyways, is the waiting. And that's all we do is wait. When they're little, you're always waiting for them to get ready. Hurry up and get ready. We're waiting for you. What do you mean you can't find your shoes? I just put them on your feet. They get older, and then what do? You wait up. Didn't you tell them 11? Yep. Where are they? And then after they get older, then they just get old and you wait for them to move out. Nobody told you that, right? Come home from the hospital. It doesn't say some assembly requires some patience required. But it's all preparatory, see, and it always takes longer than we expect, doesn't it? Always. Be patient with that process. Recognize that God is at work. Even as our kids grow up and make decisions we think are bad and do things we know are wrong, God is working. He's using all of that. All of it. To train, prepare, trust Him. And then I would add, from chapter 3, faith in God's power. And I don't even need to develop it. You can read all about it, the burning bush. Suffice it to say this. Listen, when God calls your child, they will come. You believe that? When God calls, they'll respond. They'll come. God knows how to get your attention. He knows how to get your child's attention. When you call, they may not come, but when He calls, they will come. They won't miss it. They won't ignore it. God's call is an irresistible call. So you must trust God's power to reveal Himself to your child, to call your child to Himself, to humble your child, to awaken in your child a desire to draw near to God and know God and serve God. God's power to equip your child to do whatever it is that He is calling them to do. And let's face it, all the well-intentioned motherly manipulation in the world cannot accomplish what God's power can instantaneously accomplish. If you believe that, then you have to live accordingly. You have to live by faith. And it's not faith in yourself. It's not faith in them. It's not faith in their dad. It's not faith in the church. It's not faith in their teachers or their school. It's not faith in the government. It's faith in God and His plan and promises, His protection, His provision and providence, His preparation, His power. Moms, live by faith. Let's pray. Father, we know that without faith it is impossible to please You. And so I pray that by Your grace You would enable every mom here to live by faith. That regardless of what she sees with her eyes, that she may believe that God is, that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Give us all the faith to trust, not only for our children, but for ourselves, Your plan and Your protection and Your providence and Your discipline and training and Your power to call us and change us and make us Your people, useful to Your purposes. Enlarge our faith. We believe. Help our unbelief. And we ask it for Christ's sake and His glory alone.